Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Professor Daniel R. Schwartz. Schwartz is a Frederick J. Whiten Professor of English Literature and a Stephen H. Weiss Presidential Fellow at Cornell University. He is the author of several important and groundbreaking books, including his widely read Imagining the Holocaust, and his most recent book is called In Defense of Reading, Teaching Literature in the 21st Century, published by Wiley Blackwell under the Blackwell Manifestos series. Welcome to the show, Daniel.
It's a pleasure to be with you again, Tish.
Now, you've written about so many subjects. What prompted you to write this book, In Defense of Reading?
Well, this is a book that speaks to my professional values as a scholar and as a teacher. So it's really a kind of retrospective of my career, but it also is a looking forward to what's going to happen in the profession of literature. So it kind of has a Janus-like looking forward and backward perspective. But it's very much empirically based on my experiences as a citizen of the university, as a teacher at Cornell, and as somebody who's done research in a number of areas in literature, popular culture, and the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm. Now, you argue in the beginning of your book that art is how we make sense of the world. Let's talk a little bit about that. Literature and art are windows onto who we are and who we were. Talk to us about that.
Well, I've always written according to two mantras, always the text and always historicize. And always the text emphasizes the aesthetic and close reading and the way form informs content. And always historicize insist that we think about what Frost called, in quote, the larger excruciations, unquote, namely the world beyond. But always historicize also means that we think of an author as expressing his culture, we think of his life and career in the context of that culture. So we don't think of a text in a vacuum as simply an aesthetic whole. And I've always tried to balance those two perspectives. There has been a period in the 70s and 80s where teaching literature had become very insular, and it was a high tide of literary theory. And I've kind of articulated a philosophy that I call humanistic formalism, which merges historicism and formalism. But I insist that literature is by humans, for humans, and about humans.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I guess you might say that that's my version of the Gettysburg Address.
Well, you talk about how it teaches us about our world beyond us as well. It's a way for people to travel without having to leave their homes.
Well, that's right. I've talked about that, too. I use the image as reading is odyssey. It's a kind of travel. Reading is immersion. Reading is reflection. But when we read a book, we lose ourselves in an imagined world. And we open a book, it's a kind of beginning of a trip, and you journey, whether it's a short story or a novel, you journey with the author, and you're there within the book seeing the world as he or she sees it, mm-hmm. and you're also outside thinking about the book. But what I say is that reading teaches us what other people live by, what they believe and think. And I think as a teacher, we need to teach students to read actively, that is, critically and imaginatively, and to understand implicit and explicitly arguments, but also the vision that the author has.
Mm-hmm. And books are incredibly powerful tools, too. I mean, they can be dangerous. We see how books have been banned, certain books have been banned. We see how Mark David Chapman was, you know, possessed with The Catcher in the Rye before he killed John Lennon. So talk to us about the danger of literature.
Well, yeah, that's a very good point. One has to maintain some distance both from books and from the news. That is, every time we read about a tragedy or what Frost calls the larger excruciations.
I love that.
right. Say the killings in Mumbai, we can't go out and kill ourselves. And in fact, there's a famous Emerson scholar who supposedly responded too strongly to some text. And you left as a suicide note a certain passages in literature like ripeness is all.
Mm-hmm. And then we see what happened to Salman Rushdie, for instance.
Right.
Because of his satanic verses.
Right.
Put out a death call for him.
People are sometimes unable to maintain an aesthetic distance. But really, that sort of, when we talk about people who take literature for life or who over respond, you know, you're really talking a little bit about Seymour, and whom you in A Perfect Day for Banana Fish, that it's just too much for him. And then you move really from reading the way most of us do, which is to maintain some sort of a distance, into psychosis.
Yeah, well, that can happen. But I was thinking about the importance of literature. I mean, this really stresses how it can affect cultures, politics, almost everything in regard to a civilization.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, a work of literature has a different impact for every reader. People have talked about communities of readers, and that's certainly true. People who are educated in the same tradition will read somewhat the same, but each of us is a community of one. And obviously, the examples of people wanting to kill Rushdie, that's somebody who's crossed over the edge. But we each respond to a text differently. And not only that, we respond to texts differently at different times. Texts are more mobile than you think.
They are. They're living things.
They're living things, and they take on a different kind of interpretive energy for different people. For example, when I wrote my doctoral dissertation on Conrad, nobody had talked about the homosocial and possibly homoerotic relationship between the captain and Leggett. In the 90s, I asked, and five people, including myself, participated in a volume which I edited, and I asked these people without any preconditions to write about the secret sharer, and every one of them talked about the homosexual and homosocial aspects of it. Mm-hmm. It's just that we used to read with blinders, and now we read probably with different blinders. So texts do not remain stable, and what people find in text will vary depending upon their culture, but also depending on who they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed. Now, reading, you state that reading makes us better citizens. So are you concerned about the state of our democracy because so many people seem not to read nowadays?
Well, there's a lot of talk about the death of literature, but I see both in my students and in the interest I find when I talk to colleagues and in the surge in the number of book clubs and reading groups, that there's still a great deal of interest in reading and literature.
But you also hear things like so many people only read one or two books a year, which is beyond belief to me.
Well, I think that's somewhat true. And of course, I'm in the university, and the people I know read more than one or two books a year. So I haven't taken a poll on that. I think more people download books, listen to books when they drive. But when you think of the success of the Cornell Reading Project, the book that's chosen is read all over the state by students and teachers in high school, by the parents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I was in China and I saw somebody reading the book because they were a parent. I think that there's much more reading going on than we think. And of course, then we have to say, well, what kind of reading? And to be sure, a lot of reading time is spent on the internet, but that is reading. And I think the internet provides both problems and strengths. It's very democratic. People are having dialogues on every sort of subject. But it also encourages the cult of the amateur. People think they know more than they do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and if you look into the blogosphere on a social or a political issue, you'll find that Fox News is using the same material as the liberal blogs. It's just they're putting different spins on it. There's a fairly very finite amount of information, and in fact, the sources of information seem to be diminishing because of the economic crisis, and more news bureaus are closing.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you, as a professor, think that listening to books on tape is different than reading? Is that an entirely different experience, and would you put more weight on one than the other?
Well, I'm a reader, and I almost always, when I see the film of a book, find that it's wrong. And the reason I find it's wrong is because I'm the community of one, and I've imagined it and directed it and thought about how it should be done in my own head. That's part of it. A second part is that probably reading is different from hearing and visualizing. I've always been suspicious of people who claim that you can, you know, remember every visual detail of a book. And there is a way that you're reading more internally.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, the old quizzes when I was in college about what color hat someone wore, it doesn't really mean that someone is a strong and powerful close reader. That isn't the test. So I would say it's good that people are exposed to great experiences, and it's good that there are films of Madame Bovary, but it's not the same as reading. Reading is a different and more internal activity, which I've written about it. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of, I've actually talked a little bit of how you can break reading down into phases. In the first phase is the immersion in the process of reading and the discovery of imagined worlds. It's a place where text and reader meet in a transaction. We open a text or a book, and the author and the reader meet as if together. And we kind of, it's almost as if we, working together, are charting a map on an uncharted space. We as readers suspend our sense of the world. And when we're reading, at the same time we're immersed, I think even as we're reading, there's also a kind of quest for understanding. That is, there's a kind of balance going on here, and it changes all the time. And I think that quest that goes on when you're reading along a book is the quest that speaks to the gap between what did you say, as in our conversation now, and what did you mean? And understanding is, what did you mean? So if you're reading Madame Bovary, you're going to think, maybe, what is Flaubert saying about materialism? What is he saying about people who are really anchored in this world? And what is he saying about emptiness and loneliness, and how it leads perhaps to desire for other experiences and even things? But also, finally, it's a strong critique of her, but he's trying to explain it culturally. And then you would move, I think, after that, I mean, for immersion, quest for understanding, then to what I would call self-conscious reflection. And that kind of speaks to the gap between what did you mean and what does that mean? In other words, so you're going to contextualize it in a larger framework of what you know. In other words, first you're going to clarify it, but then you're going to think about it. And that becomes a kind of more, at that point you become more of an interpretive reader. And you're kind of creating an explanatory text, historically, perhaps aesthetically, but you're stepping back. And then a further phase would be a kind of critical analysis, to really begin to think about how the text is put together. What do the original signifiers mean in terms of some larger world? So we might think then, perhaps, about how something is racist or sexist or anti-Semitic, and where a text, and sometimes that critical analysis means going beyond the author's world and to see how our sense of fairness is offended. Maybe we feel
so it can call up all kinds of things about one's own personality.
And then finally you move, and obviously these are not absolutes, but you move to a kind of cognition in terms of what we know, and we kind of, it opens up for a larger and larger perspective. And yet when you go back to rereading passages, you're sort of back at the beginning to some extent. I mean, go ahead.
But before we run out of time, you have written a great book, which we talked about in an earlier show, about imagining the Holocaust. So I want to bring that up in just one second. If you're just joining us, my guest is Professor Daniel Schwartz. We're talking about his book, In Defense of Reading, Teaching Literature in the 21st Century. And you touch on the Holocaust in this new book. Let's talk about that. Holocaust literature teaches us what?
Well, Holocaust literature teaches us what happened at a particular time and particular place. And hopefully it sounds a warning. I often say that the Holocaust literature is kind of like the night watchman that keeps us, that walks through the streets in the seven before we had streetlights, and he shouts out the times. And so I think what Holocaust literature does, and partly it's a warning of what happens when we begin to rationalize certain inhuman acts, and we begin to totemize people as other, and we begin to blame people as other. So I think that's certainly one of the purposes.
Yeah, and you talk about the fact that everyday life, the landscape just changes in Holocaust literature into this other world, from something that's normal to something that is almost like something out of a horror novel.
Well, that's right. I mean, we talked a little bit about personal psychosis. This is a kind of social psychosis where people convince one another that something is right, which isn't, and they form a kind of community believing somehow that this is justified, and that what this is what's frightening. And we saw it in Cambodia in the killing fields, a place I've been to. We see it in Bosnia and Croatia and Serbia, where we have ethnic cleansing. I mean, these mm-hmm. things happen in Rwanda. So unfortunately, these kind of horrors do occur, and that's partly one would like to think that reading in some way is helpful, but it clearly that's a kind of idealistic view. I mean, when I went into this profession, teaching was we were very idealistic about it, and mm-hmm. we thought, well, this would teach us how to make moral distinctions, and maybe it does.
And I'm sure some new teachers coming in now are idealistic as well still. Do you think?
Well, I think so. I hope so. I talk a lot in this book, and maybe we could talk a little bit about it, about the poetry of the university versus the prose of the university.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The poetry of the university is being idealistic, coming in with a sense of mission, wanting to teach students to write lucidly, think precisely, speak articulately, read perceptively, and it's a faculty pursuing research interests and hopefully finding out things other people don't know that are important and perhaps in the humanities enable people to improve their perspicacity to live more imaginatively. The prose of the university, and this is something we've been talking about a lot at Cornell, the pros of the university is that Cornell's and other universities are kind of our businesses.
They are.
Or they're becoming more and more like businesses.
They're really corporations.
Yeah. Well, they've become more and more business-like, partly because this economic decline, partly because they're competitive about their reputations. And more and more, if you want to know how universities work, you have to answer the question, follow the money. So is there still the idealistic teaching and research as I outlined it? Yes. And will it continue to exist in a world where tuition is rapidly rising and universities look for patent royalties to pay the bills? The answer is mixed. And I think right now there's no question that this crisis at Cornell and in other universities is going to affect the universities.
So are you worried about the future of teaching the humanities?
Well, I'm...
Are we going to become preoccupied just with money and the bottom line?
Well, I hope not. I mean, I talk in the conclusion a good deal about the way I'd like things to be, and I think there's really a double answer to that. Universities are operating within the current economic world, and also they have always been in a kind of economic paradox. They need public and private money to supplement tuition, but they do not mirror business in producing profits in terms of services or commodity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the first thing you have to understand about the university is at the end of the day, trucks do not line up to the buildings to take away the widgets that had been manufactured. So it's a much looser sense of job accountability, mm-hmm. and maybe it will become tighter. But I'd like to think, and I certainly have spoken about it in my book, that we're going to see a different world in literary studies, some of which will be rather positive.
Before we run out of time, I want to talk to you not just about the way the university is changing. How has teaching changed with the computer age? You touch on that as well.
I think that it's easier to write on the internet for students. I think they have more time. Less time is spent writing and rewriting for them and for me. And second of all, research is easier done on mm-hmm. on the internet.
You've got to make sure that they're getting facts. And
yeah.
I
think that's improved
the
a lot.
Amateur. What was it that the guy
yeah,
said?
The cult of the amateur.
Yeah.
In early days, you would sometimes get complete nonsense. You'd ask the students where they got it, and it was from the internet. But the internet has become more accurate with dates and facts, and Wikipedia is with its ways of correcting mm-hmm. have become
it's
better.
It's become much more sophisticated.
Yeah, so I think it gives them more time. Clearly, their way of being is much more electronic, whether it be Twitter or iPhone or text messaging. Mm-hmm. It's a different world. And, of course, that's writing and reading also. And I actually think some use a listserv in my courses and find out if they propose simple responses to questions I ask, it can develop into sophisticated papers. And the fact I ask them to make 3 or 4 contributions a term on the listserv, which creates a community, and also it sometimes helps them write papers. So I think that it's easier for them to write, to keep notes, and that makes it more efficient. I'd like to go back just a tad to the one question you asked, and what would happen and what will happen in literary studies.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's going to be much more dialogue with anthropology, neurology, and cognitive psychology.
Really?
We're going to think about, try to understand why we need to tell stories and read about them. Why is it, in fact, we live by stories? We're always speaking about, writing about our lives and revising them. And there's always this gap between what happened and how we remember what happened, another gap between how we remember and how we tell. We're constantly reconfiguring our narratives, even each day, our plans, how we're going to spend the day. We're going to work all morning, except the phone rings and we don't do it. So then we do something else. So each of us is continually writing and rewriting the meaning of our of events, telling and retelling with variations the basic story of our lives. And I think we may have a biological need to do some of this. There may be something that we don't understand. And so these are going to be some of the questions that I think people are going to ask. And I think all I would like, what I'd like to see happen is less jargon, more engagement of the serious reading public, more perhaps public intellectuals. I think one of the problems in the humanities in the 70s is we kind of retreated into our own world.
I was going to say that. It became a bubble, didn't it?
Well, I think it did. And also sometimes we use bromides to explain things without really understanding. I mean, we would put the mantle of Marxism or neocolonialism on every phenomenon, and sometimes it didn't quite apply. I mean, as a friend of mine said, observing the situation in Zimbabwe while I was visiting Zimbabwe, colonialism was bad. This, meaning Mugabe and his abusing his people, is worse. And I think we need to be more, and that brings me to a second point I'd like to see, which is more empiricism and more respect for facts. I think there was a time that we just kind of, the theory became a kind of braille. And
well, people were wandering through political times, too, and that was reflected.
Right.
In some of these decisions and observations and even intellectualism.
Yeah. By braille, I mean the predetermined shapes came to the fingertips, but you're absolutely right about that.
Mm-hmm.
And while I argue for pluralism, which means using different approaches at different texts and different intellectual problems, I often say texts teach us how to read them. I also think that pluralism doesn't mean all approaches are equal. It isn't a kind of relativism.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think synthesizing and organizing knowledge based upon facts, based upon close readings of history, that is really understanding what happens, rather than just kind of throwing out some cliches or shibboleths, would be something that would be very good.
Mm-hmm. And you talked in the book too also about how the future of literary studies will be more global.
Yeah.
And not just with these other disciplines wandering into it, but more global. I mean, different cultures that we never had access to, and we do now because of the internet. And
well, I think also it's the internet, it's travel. English becoming the international language also helps quite a bit. They're really, for the French used to think there was an international language, but there really wasn't, except the people who spoke French. We all had to learn at one point. But there's going to be more globalization. There's going to be more focus on non-Western literature.
There is now, right? I mean,
yeah, I think that's the direction we're going to go. There's going to be more work, I think. And of course, I've contributed to this field and the relationship between modern literature and modern art, but all literature and art. And we're going to understand that art is not simply representative, but is actually is functional in Africa, that the masks are not just things to put on the wall, but things that are used in various social and religious rituals. So I think there's going to be a great deal more emphasis on globalization, and this may change departments. I mean, there may be departments of literature rather than departments of English literature.
I want to ask you this, as a professor, how do writers become classics and then taught in English classes? I mean, you talk about Conrad and Joyce and Virginia Woolf. Who were some of the more contemporary writers of the last 20 years that academia has decided is a classic worth teaching?
Well,
Toni Morrison, I know, probably.
Yeah. And I mean, this is what's called canonization, and certainly when I was in graduate school, there was a much tighter and shorter list of that.
Mm-hmm. And it was mainly males.
It was mainly males, although that can be overstated too, because if anybody's thought about the great 19th century novels, they're going to say Emma, Wuthering Heights, and Middlemarch.
Oh,
so
that's true.
I think we've been brainwashed to think of the bad old days more than they actually were, completely bad, although certainly
at least we've added to the list, though.
Yeah,
there were three women writers.
Right. Well, we could come up with a lot of many poets. Yeah,
many poets,
yeah.
Indeed.
I agree with you that certainly there was a male hegemony in that list. But what's happened is that identity politics, feminism, various ethnic studies have changed the academic landscape. I mean, as I said, I think in my Holocaust book, if I had written that book when I came out of graduate school, in my first book, I would have been driven to the airport at tenure time. You couldn't do that. And feminism and black studies, all of that made working on ethnicity and even working on popular culture more
probably frowned
easier.
Upon, huh?
But, well, it was then. Now it isn't. Mm-hmm. So you ask me who's being written about. Well, my serious answer among novelists would be Updike and Bellow and Morrison and Roth, a good candidate for the next American Nobel, particularly now that Updike died. But considering the place of pop culture, the Beatles, people are writing much more about popular culture.
As well as Bob Dylan.
Well, Dylan, the answer to practically who wrote every song is Bob Dylan. I was talking about pop music with a student the other day, and she had no idea that songs like Forever Young or Knock, Knock, Knocking on Heaven's Door were, in fact, Dylan songs.
I've had people say that. Was that a Dylan song?
Right.
Songs
so,
that we know, yeah.
But I think that even the focus on contemporary literature is a switch. I mean, when I did a year in UK in my junior year, the attitude was after Hardy, you could do your own reading. There was no, and certainly there's not much point. And they do everything after Hardy in a week of a 2-year course. So I think that, and even now, when I was in graduate school, the idea is you read contemporary literature on your own. So clearly, this is a burgeoning field.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still a lot of suspicion that we should teach too much of that. I think it's a good idea to teach the major contemporary writers.
Mm-hmm.
But whose major changes very, very frequently?
We only have about 1 minute left, so I wanted to ask you, what are you working on next?
Well, I'm working on a book on the New York Times, they've been very generous. They've given me access. I've interviewed 40 of the luminaries one-to-one and have them taped. And it's a book that's moving towards completion. And I'm talking contract with somebody, but we'll see how that comes.
Oh, that's great. What an interesting subject.
But it's called Crisis and Turmoil in the New York Times, and it picks up really the entire crisis in the media and talks about how the Times is going to adjust to the contemporary era. Will there be a Times? I think probably yes. They're the last man standing.
Mm-hmm.
I talk about the history of the Times and the difficulties of the internet and the business model.
Well, we'll look forward to that, Daniel, and I'll have you back to talk about that. Daniel Schwartz, thank you so much for being with us.
It's always a privilege, Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.